Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, two reports that explore the issue of crime and punishment. Forgiveness and redemption. We talk to the founder of the Cherish Life Circle in New York City that reaches out to the families of murder victims and to the criminals on death row. And From Death to Life. A leading anti-death penalty activist in the US and a Catholic convert talks about how his views changed after he became a prison director and had to supervise executions there. Families of murder victims and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherish Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherish Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherish Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was an ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I have in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue and to try to prevent what the incoming governor hopes to bring? So we came together, as we do, educated people who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that. Now, one of the things that we did at that time was we circulated a document which has been signed by people in Rome as well as other parts of the world. It is called a Declaration of Life, and that document says in its essence that I, the signer, whoever that signer is so opposed to the death penalty that were I to be murdered, I would not want my killer executed. That gives people an opportunity to speak very strongly for themselves without condemning people who entertain different views.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherish Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered. It is not a Catholic service, because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes, we had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. One of the surprising things about these services, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, "I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured." So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19, was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, the judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do, you know, negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year, and we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for, and clearly being abused, and they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the three children played with the dog. They owned it. They loved it. And when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag. And she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set, but that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal." He said, "I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog." And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person. And the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps. And there was a young boy, all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child. And I said, "Honey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "My mama sent me." I said, "But do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered." "How old was he?" "He was 15. My mama's sick, she couldn't come, so she sent me." "How did you get here?" "I took two trains." The boy was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list, and we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook, and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him. But he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more?
No,
about him?
Nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy from New York City. Today, the United States is the only Western democratic nation that imposes the death penalty on its citizens. But while around 2 out of 3 Americans currently support capital punishment in cases where a person is convicted of murder, there has been a sharp fall in the number of death sentences handed down and in the number of executions eventually carried out. Figures show that the execution rate in the US is around 50% lower compared to the late 1990s. One reason is that state governors, who have the final say on this matter, are more willing to grant clemency where there is any doubt. Another reason for shifting attitudes is the use of more advanced DNA testing, a procedure which has led to scores of death row prisoners being acquitted. One of the US's leading campaigners against the death penalty is Ron McAndrew, who grew up as a strong supporter of capital punishment. McAndrew's views on the death penalty changed dramatically after he served as director of the state prison in Florida, where his job included supervising executions of those on death row. He began by telling us why the death penalty fails to act as a deterrent and reduce levels of violent crime in his country.
I believe that the death penalty increases murders. We know this from the European example, where you do not have the death penalty and you have much less murders than you do in the United States. The death penalty is not a deterrent to murder. It is not a deterrent to any form of crime. It is simply a barbaric politician's tool.
McAndrew went on to explain why he supported the death penalty when younger. And that's why he ended up taking the job as director or warden of the state prison in Florida in 1996.
I grew up in a conservative, very rural country area of North Carolina. I was raised by conservative grandparents who supported the death penalty like everybody else in our community. It was just a very natural thing to support. If you kill someone, you should be killed. I mean, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The biblical quote was quoted constantly. I found myself one day being asked to go to Florida State Prison as the new warden in 1996. The secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections, Mr. Harry K. Singletary Jr., called me on the phone and said, "Ron, I would like for you to take over Florida State Prison. I'd like for you to be the warden there. It's an enormous responsibility." He said, "I need someone who's very strong and can handle that place. But I have one question I must ask you. Will you have any problems," he said, "carrying out the death penalty?" And my response was very quick and very sure. I said, "No, sir."
But very quickly after starting his new job at this prison, McAndrew told us how the first seeds of doubt about the justice of the death penalty were planted in his mind.
I started practicing with the death team on carrying out the death penalty. But a few things started happening that I had not counted on. I never realized that I would be the person to meet the family of the condemned and also the family and friends of the victim, or at least the alleged victim. I found myself reading the investigation that had sent this man to death row. As a past investigator, having investigated hundreds of crimes, including murder, I found the investigation rather weak, and I couldn't understand how a jury could have sent this particular individual to death row. I asked an attorney friend who worked in this field, and he told me, "Ron, don't read that." He said, it'll only mess up your mind, because he said, quite frankly, there's no justice in our courts in terms of the death penalty. He said, it's simply a question of which attorney is the best actor and the best convincing attorney in terms of telling the jury their side of the story.
As McAndrew went on to explain, it was precisely the close contact he had with the families of both the condemned and of the murder victim that provided him with his first moral awakening.
First execution, my first moral shock. I found the mother and two sisters of the condemned waiting to see me outside of my office one morning. And I had a policy of seeing everyone, so I invited them into my office. And I sat across from these three women, and I could tell that they were horribly distressed because someone that they loved very much was about to be killed, purposefully killed. "We have some questions, and will I be able to see my brother?" the sister told me, and I said, "Of course," and I said, I'll bend the rules as much as I can to allow you to visit as often as possible. But when the mother looked me straight in the eye with tears streaming down her face, and she said, "Warden, I just have one question. Will I be able to hug my baby before y'all kill him?" That hit me like a ton of bricks. She left me with an uneasy feeling. I felt my conscience crawling right up my back. I found myself getting to know the prisoner, the condemned. I saw him at his cell every day. I carried messages from his attorney. I realized suddenly that this was not so mechanical. It was not so administrative. It was getting very personal. I then had the sister of the victim, who was very angry and full of hate, and she was looking for revenge. She asked me, she said, "Warden, I want to go to that execution." I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll approve that." She said, "I want a front row seat. I want to sit right in front of the electric chair. I want to watch this man burn to death."
He shares with us his memories of what happened on the day of the first execution he was in charge of supervising in the Florida State Prison.
The morning of the execution, I thought it would be very automatic, very easy. I went to the death cell. I sat on the bed next to the inmate, and I told him, I said, "I hate to do this, but the law requires me to." I said, "I have to read you your death warrant." I just said, "It's signed by the governor and by the attorney general." And I started reading, and it's a rather long document. And I started reading this, and about halfway through the death warrant, the prisoner who was handcuffed and sitting next to me, he could tell I was having a hard time getting the words out. And he sort of elbowed me a little bit with his left elbow. He said, "It's okay, Warden. I'm ready." He said, "I've made my peace with God. Here, I'm about to kill him, and he's trying to make it easy for me." It told me very quickly which of us was the strongest, because I didn't have that kind of nerve. But I took this man into the death chamber. I put him to death. I watched the family member of the victim stare with hate all across her face throughout the execution, with her arms crossed, very angry look, and the condemned was concentrating so strongly on his final prayer that I don't think he even noticed her. I don't think he noticed any of the witnesses.
One of the most pivotal and most shocking executions he witnessed at the Florida State Prison came when, due to a malfunction, flames shot out from the face and head of the condemned man when the electrical current was applied to him in the electric chair. The prisoner in question at that botched execution was a Cuban refugee called Pedro Medina. McAndrew told us more about that gruesome incident in which he saw Medina literally being burnt alive.
This man had no education. He had serious mental problems. He certainly did not know how to interact socially any place with anyone. He had lived a wild life on the streets and a wild life in prisons. He needed psychological help more than anything else. But I went through the same process, took Pedro Medina into the death chamber. I remember watching the engineer remove the sponge from the saline solution and squeeze it before he put it on Pedro Medina's head just before the execution. And I questioned the amount of water he had squeezed out of the sponge. But the chief electrician said it was fine. Everything's fine, he said. So when I gave the order to the executioner to turn on the electricity, there was an immediate fire. A flame dipped down out of a copper helmet on Pedro Medina's head and came straight up in front of my face. His head was on fire. I was aghast. So was everybody else. The electrician, who was wearing the big heavy gloves and had the capability of removing the helmet, asked me if we should continue. There's no way I could stop. And I told him to continue. I walked out of that death chamber that day knowing that I had personally helped burn a human being to death, burn him to death. I hoped, but somehow in the back of my mind, I still supported the death penalty. And today I can't understand why, but I did. The governor was very angry about the fire. He actually fired me and rehired me in the same day, and then ordered me to go to Texas and to learn how to do lethal injections. So I went to Huntsville, Texas, and I worked with the death team there for 5 lethal injections. I brought all of this knowledge back to Florida, purchased all of the equipment, and got Florida prepared for the new way of killing people who had possibly killed other people.
But it wasn't just that botched execution that was causing McAndrew to grow increasingly uneasy about the use of the death penalty. He says cases involving the wrongful convictions of a number of men on death row often kept him awake at night.
Sometimes people are wrongfully convicted. I had an experience that keeps me awake at nights. I went to speak in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania about 2 years ago, and I was one of the guest speakers there, and I was walking down the hallway of the large hotel where we were all staying. And I saw a man standing there in the middle of the foyer, and he looked familiar to me. And I saw him look at me, and he opened his arms up, and he wrapped his arms around me, and he gave me a big hug. That was Mr. Juan Melendez. The last time I had seen Melendez was he was in a prison cell at Florida State Prison, and he was on death row. He was found innocent and removed. When I laid down in my bed that night and I tried to close my eyes, I had this vision of me taking Juan into the death chamber and putting him in the electric chair and killing him. And there he's totally innocent of all crimes. He's a wonderful man who should never have gone to prison, but he had a crooked sheriff who was running for election. He needed to catch somebody doing a big crime to get his name in the newspapers. So the sheriff succeeded in what he wanted to do. And this poor man who had come to Florida from Puerto Rico found himself sitting on Florida's death row for 20 years. What a horrible thing to happen.
McAndrew told us he prays just as hard for murder victims as he does for the condemned prisoner. And as he goes on to explain, there are special reasons for that.
There's murder in my own family. My sister-in-law, Linda McAndrew, was murdered in Charlotte, North Carolina in the year 1990. We miss her very much. She was a precious part of our family. She was killed by a horrible man who later committed suicide in prison himself. Today, I find myself praying for him, just as I pray for my sister-in-law, because that's the right thing to do. That's the moral thing to do.
MacAndrew asked for and gained a transfer away from the state prison in Florida to one in Orlando and started to examine his conscience more and more deeply until one day he realized that he could no longer support the death penalty.
I really did some very serious soul searching about why we were killing people who had possibly killed other people to show our children that killing was the right thing to do, or more appropriately, the wrong thing to do. I had been attending Mass for a long time with my wife, more to please her than to please God. But I found myself at a Mass shortly after that, and as we prayed, something I normally didn't do, I found myself asking God to forgive me for ever having taken part in the death penalty or for having ever supported it. And I knew that day that there was no way, no way on God's good earth that I could ever, ever again support the death penalty.
Since that pivotal day in his life, MacAndrew has become one of the leading activists against the death penalty in the US and now lectures and campaigns against it throughout the nation. And it wasn't by chance that his change of view on capital punishment coincided with his decision to join the Catholic Church.
The death penalty in the United States is there for one reason and one reason only. It's a political tool. Politicians know that statistics show that approximately 70% of Americans support the death penalty, just as I did, and probably for the same reasons that I did, simply because it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and they've been told since they were little kids that this is the right thing to do. So if a politician looks at these figures, he says to himself, well, am I going to go for 30% of the votes or am I going to go for 70% of the votes? If I'm asked if I support the death penalty, I'm going for 70%. So even politicians that I've known in the past who are Catholic men who should not be supporting the death penalty because they know that the church tells them that it's wrong, they still do. I can tell you that this process that I went through in terms of examining my conscience and going to Mass, I was not a Catholic man. I simply attended Mass because my wife is a lifelong Catholic. But through this process, I found myself sitting with a priest. I thought I could just walk into his office and say, Father Joe, I'd like to become a Catholic. Can you sign me up? And I found out it wasn't that easy. I had to go to catechism, in fact, for a year and a half. And then on one beautiful Easter day, I became a Roman Catholic and a very proud one. And my faith has grown every year since.
I was speaking to Ron MacAndrew, a leading campaigner against the death penalty in the US.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.